You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we only send dick pics to women in Texas, because everything is bigger there. Get it? I'm your host, Justin Amlazeski, and if you live in Texas, Midsiders, can you let us know what you think of this new law that says sending unsolicited, explicit photos to someone via, I don't know, is it just via text? Does it cover email? Does it cover tweets? Does it cover Instagram? It seemed like an oversight if it doesn't cover Instagram. Or is it only online dating? I don't know. Tell us all you can about this new law that prevents men from using the technique of just sending a dick pic out of anger or desperation. The Hail Mary technique has now been taken out of Texas. We're just like, I got no other options. I'll just show her my dick and hope, you know, she sees my dick and is like, yeah, I want to fuck that dick. Yeah. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. And Daniel, as our legal expert on the show, I have to ask you, are dick pics covered under the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Can they be regulated as interstate commerce? Well, Wickard v. Filburn tells us that it doesn't even have to be interstate to be interstate commerce. If you do enough microactivity within your own state, that affects the interstate commerce, and therefore
it can be regulated. If you do enough microactivity, does this give a clear, if you just have a micropenis, you can just send it to whoever you want in any state?
So what I'm saying is if you're sending enough of those pics within your own state, that could affect the pics in other states, the quantity or value of pics in other states, and therefore Congress could regulate it. I think the better question, if we're going on the legal side, is are pictures that are lewd in nature sent to individuals in terms of a courting process protected under the First Amendment? Notice how I said that very convolutedly as to avoid certain phrases taken out of context that could be used against me at a later time.
Take all my phrases out of context.
So what do you think? Are pictures of your penis sent to women protected by free speech?
Well, this is something that you're going to have to help me understand in general, is if it's a private conversation, how does government have a right to be involved in that at all?
That's kind of my point, right?
I mean, if I threaten you right now, if I'm like, Daniel, I'm going to fucking go to D.C. and murder you, can now somebody just report me to the police because I just said that?
Well, yes, because it's an initiation of violence. So that is not protected speech, but I don't think the court has quite taken up this particular issue to see if it is protected under the First Amendment.
Well, then now, the question here is, isn't Texas assuming in rape culture now? They've taken the premise of rape culture, because they could be arguing that sending a dick pic is an initiation of violence.
Oh.
Initiation of force.
Could be.
Because you're saying you're going to rape someone by sending a dick pic.
Could be. Interesting. I don't know. I doubt it's protected by the First Amendment. I'm being a little bit coy here. But Texas on a rampage recently with a lot of laws that have to do with technology and updating regulations to meet the times. And for the most part, I think they've done a good job of doing things like making it so children don't need permits to have lemonade stands, for instance. Bravo, Texas.
Children don't need permits to have lemonade stands, but I need a permit to send my dick to someone.
Yeah, I'm probably fine with this law. I'm not going to lie to you.
It's just funny that I saw a video of the governor of Texas on Twitter being like, obviously he didn't say dick pics, right? But he's basically like, yeah, you can't send dick pics anymore. And the idea that a governor of one of the states actually made a video of that and there's laws about that is just one of the fucking funniest things to me.
It is so 2019 that it's hard to deal with.
Well, there are lots of things that are hard to deal with in 2019. One of them being that we don't know where William is. Hopefully he'll be here for Life on the Midside. And many other ones are news stories. So why don't we get into that now in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Before we get to the very farcical news for this week, I want to remind you about Patreon. That's patreon.com/themidside. Patreon is a platform that allows you, the listener, to help us, the podcasters, in our endeavors here to host the show, buy advertising, etc. What you do is you go and you agree to give us a couple bucks every time we produce one of these shows, or whatever you can afford, and then we thank you for it. In fact, we thank you sometimes with exclusive Patreon-only content, so why don't you check that out over at patreon.com/themidside. The Hugo Awards. For those of you unfamiliar, the Hugo Awards are the annual, let's call them the Emmys or the Oscars, but for science fiction writing. And the 2019 Hugo Awards were held in Dublin this year. And as in almost all the previous recent years, women swept the awards. Interesting. So it has been, this article says, as has been the welcome trend for the past few years, women once again almost completely swept the Hugos. And then it goes on to list the various winners, include Mary Robnett Cowles, The Calculating Stars. For those of you who are interested, it's the first in her Lady Astronaut series. That won Best Novel. Artificial Condition by Martha Wells took home Best Novella. If at first you don't succeed, Try, Try Again by Zen Cho won Best Novelette, which is different from a novella. And A Witch's Guide to Escape, a practical compendium of portal fantasies by Alex E. Harrow, won Best Short Story. So why, Justin, is it notable that the Hugo Awards have been swept by women in the previous years? Aren't award shows regularly swept by men?
Yeah, it's an interesting question you raise, and I think it's the right one to look at this from, and I think we can have a discussion about that. The reason it's interesting is because this is another example of the way social justice has infiltrated the culture in a way that makes it so it's not on merit, and it's about reparations. That's not the right word. It's about...
It's kind of the right word.
Okay, so maybe it is the right word. The idea that they're giving this to women not because women earned it, but because they're trying to make sure they're more representative because they're less represented in the past. The idea that an incorrect thing in the past, an immoral thing in the past, you have to do more immorality in the present or the future. Years ago, 2013, there was a group called Sad Puppies who were trying to, I don't know why they're called Sad Puppies, someone else could look that up, but they were trying to influence the Hugo Awards. And let me just read to you the Wikipedia summary, which I think should be enough, Daniel, to show you why I wanted to have this on this show. This is at the top when you go to the Sad Puppies Wikipedia entry, above the picture of the Sad Puppies logo, which is three sad puppies in spacesuits with a rocket over them. I mean, this is funny enough on its own without the insane social justice background to this. But Sad Puppies was an unsuccessful right-wing anti-diversity voting campaign intended to influence the outcome of the annual Hugo Awards, the longest running prize since 1953, for science fiction or fantasy works. So
okay,
that description has been said a million times about any group that isn't insanely left-wing. And here's the thing. If not for this idea that we have to give more to women because they were, you know, nominated or award less in the past, what are the actual statistical odds that in anything more men or more women would be nominated? Now, obviously, I'm not talking about like the NFL awards. Obviously, more men are going to be nominated for that. But in a field where gender theoretically does not and should not matter, isn't it insane that the majority of the nominees were women? Doesn't that show a agenda with the nominations?
Well, let me throw it back at you with the question that I think, to play a little bit of devil's advocate, that women would ask, which is, what about the years when men were solely nominated? Should that have happened? Well, or if you look at other awards and men are more nominated than women, should that happen?
So I think pre-show you raised an interesting question. I think the question for that is, what are the percentage of people writing, right? We would need to know that, which unfortunately I don't know the statistics on that. But it's also what I said to you, just because, yeah, it was wrong in the past doesn't mean you do a new wrong to correct that prior wrong.
Yeah, and I think it's because social justice isn't actually interested in justice. We've explored this quite a bit on the show. Social justice is more like social equity or social equality, or I think reparations is an interesting term because the concept is you can only right the wrongs of the past by bringing down the oppressor in the current, in the now. And so the oppressor here is men. And so men have to be brought down a peg. Men have to be subjugated in order for the past injustices to be rectified. And these are the same people who want to take away all your guns, just to be clear.
I love it when it goes back to the gun point all the time. That's so real and people don't understand it. To sort of drive the point home a little bit more, that this isn't simply about like making women equal to men. I just want to read to you the plot description on Wikipedia of the book that won the Best Novel Award.
I can't wait.
So it's called The Calculating Stars, which should be the first indication because that's a shit title. Shortly after President Thomas Dewey leads the United States to a victory in the space race in 1952, a meteorite strikes Chesapeake Bay, obliterating most of the eastern seaboard. In the aftermath, mathematician and former WASP pilot Elma York calculates that the resulting climate change will make the planet uninhabitable within 50 years. This threat accelerates efforts to colonize space and leads to Elma joining the International Aerospace Coalition in its attempt to reach first the moon and then Mars. And WASP stands for the Women Air Force Service Pilots. Which was a real thing.
Not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Yeah, well, that's why I said that. It's very confusing if you didn't know that.
Well, that sounds insufferable.
Are they wasps? Like, if they're a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and they're in the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, are they wasps squared?
Man, two
wasps.
What
if the movie Ant-Man and the Wasp was just Ant-Man hanging out with a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant?
Kind of is. Not totally, but a little bit. It is. Also, no one saw it, so we don't really know. That sounds just like, was it the South Park episode making fun of Family Guy where it's just a bunch of manatees in a pool picking beach balls that have various nouns, verbs, and situations on them, and that's how they figure out what Family Guy skit to write.
Yeah,
this just sounds like you have a bingo ball hopper of social justice commentary and you're just turning it and one comes out and it's like, boom, climate change, boom, gender equality, boom, hate the United States, etc. And then they just wrote it into a book, and science fiction is what it necessarily has to be because it has no attachment with reality.
Right, exactly, 100%. I feel like they're bastardizing science fiction. I mean, for me, Daniel, and this will be interesting to ask your perception. Looking back and reflecting, I feel like science fiction is sort of the first place where I got my libertarian ideas from, or there was a place where I could see libertarian ideas and my libertarian thoughts reflected back at me. I mean, even when I think of, like, Sliders, the TV show. Do you remember Sliders, the TV show?
Yeah. Something. It was like Stargate meets Quantum Leap.
Basically, that's probably how they pitched it. Honestly, that's probably how they pitched it. But yeah, Jerry O'Connell invented a machine where he could jump between parallel universes. And the parallel universes he went to were very much, you know, if you looked at the way they approached them, they were designed in a way that often promoted libertarianism. And I believe I read about the person who created it, and he was libertarian. So even on television, science fiction was more libertarian. And now it seems like they've gone in the complete opposite direction. So it's interesting to me that first off, the genre evolved that way. And second off, that it's become more leftist.
Because for these futures to exist, you have to have some amount of freedom. You have to be able to do things in order to get such advanced technologies. If the government is constantly telling you, no, stop, don't do that, you're never going to reach the future. Authors like Orson Scott Card and, of course, Robert Heinlein, very libertarian in their presentation of the future and the world that they want. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is maybe one of the best libertarian novels ever written, up there with Atlas Shrugged and the works of Ayn Rand, and it's coming out as a movie soon, so you should check the book out before the movie hits.
And after, probably, too, just to get that bad taste out of your mouth. But speaking of movies and classic sci-fi writers, I'm assuming you're also a Ray Bradbury fan?
To some degree, yes. Okay. Although I'm much more a fan. He's Star Trek, right? Just so before I start talking idiocy.
No. Ray Bradbury is the author of Fahrenheit
455. Fahrenheit 455. Yeah.
451, yeah. I believe, but yes.
Whatever. Yes. Also fantastic. Sorry.
Right, one of the classic
sci-fi writers.
Gene Roddenberry,
who I'm thinking of. Jeez.
Right. Understandable mistake. Understandable mistake. But I actually was going to relate this to Star Wars. I learned something recently that George Lucas's original script was sent to Ray Bradbury, who passed it off to a friend of his to help rewrite it. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So, Ray Bradbury influenced Star Wars?
Good. Probably that's what made it awesome.
I was going to say, that explains a lot, I feel like.
Yeah.
I wish Ray Bradbury had just written Star Wars. I probably would have loved the original trilogy, but it's just very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Yes. Some other interesting things happening up north. Some Canadian news for our Canadian listeners.
Yeah, before you continue, I just want to say, I'm sorry, Canadians. And the reason I'm sorry is, like, I keep thinking it's bad here in America, and then I see stories pop up in my Twitter feed from Canada, and I'm just like, Jesus. Human rights councils and shit? Wow.
It's like looking into a crystal ball that shows our very ugly future, though. It's really, this is what's coming here, America.
But at least they're polite about it.
So here's what's coming. An Edmonton area single father is facing a human rights complaint for allegedly discriminating against a male babysitter by asking him about his age and gender. The date of the complaint is all the way back in 2017 when Todd, who doesn't want his name published, posted a babysitting ad on the internet. He was looking for someone to look after his then 5 and 8-year-old children for the evening. One of the potential babysitters who responded was James, unpronounceable last name, who filed the complaint against Todd. According to the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, which is representing Todd pro bono, Todd's evening's plans fell through, so he canceled the babysitter. But James said that he was canceled because Todd asked him his age and his sex. And then when he responded with his age and his sex, he was no longer in communication with Todd. So, of course, this is against the law in Canada because you can't discriminate based on age and sex. But hey, it turns out, to no one's surprise, that this is not the first lawsuit that has been instituted by James. He also sued a mother back in 2014 for basically doing the same thing. So, Justin, do people have a right to pick and choose who babysits their children?
No, only the government should pick for them, or it should be random, completely random. It should be like chat roulette, where you just go in there and every once in a while you see a dick. That's what picking people should be like to babysit your children, which actually raises this all raises an interesting question. So Texas has a law that you can't send dick pics to people anymore, right? Yes. Does Canada have a law that you can't discriminate against people who send you dick pics? And what I mean by that is if you send an unsolicited dick pic in online dating and then they stop talking to you, can you then sue them for discrimination against your dick?
Especially if you identify as dick pic sexual. Like that's,
is there a way
that's
to
how
not
you express your sexuality.
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is like, this is so ridiculous because this is like a basic thing. This is a basic thing where you should be able to decide who babysits your children based on any criteria you want. What if I find out a babysitter, now I don't have kids, but if I have a kid, I found out a babysitter hated Zack Snyder movies. Could I say no? I wouldn't want somebody who hated Zack Snyder movies babysitting my hypothetical children. The point
that's
I'm
right.
making, though, I mean, is I think this story really makes us look at the word discrimination. And this is something I always say to people, especially this is something I say to students about the usage of words with connotation and denotation. Discrimination is not a bad word unless you add in all this cultural context where they taught us it's bad. It's important to be discriminating. Don't we say someone who's like a really good critic for food is discriminating? He has discriminating taste. She has discriminating taste as a wine critic. But now when we're discriminating about who raises our children, I mean, in the example of this man, wouldn't it make sense that he would want a woman to babysit his children because maybe the wife isn't around anymore. Maybe she died. Maybe they're divorced. And this is the way to make sure there's a female influence on his children as well. So it just seems very, they're taking away your basic individuality by saying you can't be discriminating by using it in that negative way.
It's also, so there's the male part to this. The age part is also a factor. The guy at the time was 28 years old, a 28-year-old male. In my experience, not a lot of 28-year-old males are doing babysitting from looking at babysitters. So it would sort of take me by surprise, and it would sort of put me off if a 28-year-old male responded to an ad that I put up and said, hey, I want to babysit your 5- and 8-year-olds. That's not really a thing that they do, and it's not a thing they do because it turns out that people with different genders have different preferences for careers, for leisure activity, for all sorts of things. And 28-year-old male is not really the demographic for babysitter. Now, what if this was a 16-year-old male or a 17-year-old male? I think it would be a different kind of story. But if you're presented with multiple options for your babysitter, and one of them is an 18-year-old girl, and the other is a 22-year-old girl, and the other is a 40-year-old woman, and the other is a 28-year-old male, I feel like there's a pretty easy prioritization that goes on there based on reality, based on the experiences of just looking at the world and seeing what is and what people choose to do.
Okay. In response to that, I'm going to make a really offensive joke, but then I'm going to unpack it to talk about talking about. You know what a 28-year-old male who wants to babysit is in the likelihood of? Pedophilia. Now, the point I'm making is...
Careful, this guy's litigious.
Okay, I know. That's why I said it's an offensive joke, and that's why I put the buffer in front of it, and I'm going to put the buffer after it. Where the buffer is, if you have to protect your children, even if it's a 0.5% chance, even if there's a 1% chance he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. No, not to quote Batman and Batman vs. Superman, but if there's even a 0.5% chance, don't you not take that with your children? Because that's something that if you expose them for life, they're fucked. And I don't mean that in the literal sense. I mean that you're just going to screw up their entire psychology and everything.
Certainly,
you get the point I'm making,
right?
When
it's like, we live in the middle of nowhere. This is the only guy who within 40 miles has agreed to watch our kids. That's a different proposition, and you're 0.5% chance is that you evaluate it differently than if you live in Edmonton and you have multiple people responding to your ad and you have a plethora of options. Then you calculate risk differently. Not saying that this guy is anything bad. It's just unusual. And it would pique my negative interest if this guy.
Well, right. The guy's not looking at the market he's in and figuring out how to best market himself for anything. He's like trying to sell candy apples to people, and he's like, there's a chance that our candy apples have razor blades. They don't, but there's a 0.5% chance. Are you going to take that chance when you can go next door to downtown Disney and buy their candy apples?
This ultimately has to do with rights. Now, we talked about a story before, I think, also out of Canada, maybe out of Britain.
Okay,
about
before you go to the rights thing, can I just say, whatever happened to, you know, getting the high school girl next door, the next door neighbor high school girl to babysit your kids? Why are we going on apps to get babysitters now? Like, just stop it with the apps, people.
Two things to respond realistically to your question, although it was funny. One is the next door girl now has no interest in working.
That's true.
Because of affluence and doesn't need the money.
And why would you want her to put your kids on Instagram? Yeah.
And two is, in areas like where I live, the market for babysitting is ridiculous. And so if you do find someone within your, you know, let's say 2-3 block range, they are almost 100% certain to already have a full-time babysitting gig. The market is insane right now because more people are working, more women are working, and there are fewer babysitters because it's a low-ish paying gig, although the market is rising for that. And then also parents are insanely particular about who they want.
I remember when I was a kid, my parents would just give $20 to the girl next door, or the girl two houses down. That was it.
No longer. Now you need background checks and multiple forms of ID and 10
Make
years
America
experience.
Great again, man. Can we go back to that?
So on the rights thing, though, we talked about a story where a person who identifies as a woman but was born a man and still has male genitalia is suing someone because a day spa won't wax her testicles, right? And we were talking about rights issues, and it was very good to boil it down to the fact of, can the law force a woman to touch another man's genitalia? Can the law force a woman to do that? That's ultimately the question at hand. And that's, if you boil it down here, it's not as offensive, but it is a question of rights, where it's, can the law force you to bring a 28-year-old male into your home who you don't want in your home? Can the law force you to do that? Can the law force you to have this person watch your children?
And to be clear, when you say can, you don't mean like, is the law able to? Yes, of course there can be a law that passed that said that, but we mean should the law morally.
Yes. Should they be able to force you to bring a 28-year-old male into your home and put him in charge of your children? That's ultimately what we're talking about here in reality. In the terms of what would actually happen on a day-to-day basis, should the law be able to force you to bring this man into your home? I think the answer is clearly no. And yes, people are going to be discriminated against under the Daniel T. Richards, Justin M. Lesniewski regime. People
See,
will
not
be discriminated.
Easy. It's not easy.
But it's also not my name. Justin M. Lesniewski regime. Right? And that sucks. And the people who discriminate for terrible reasons, for reasons of race or gender or whatever, when it's totally arbitrary, those people are immoral and should be ostracized as much as possible. But on the flip side of that, you have these instances where people will be forced to do things they are uncomfortable with for the sake of quote-unquote not discriminating. When in fact, in these cases, it is perfectly appropriate to discriminate for all sorts of reasons.
Well, so, and also, Daniel, what I would like to add to what you just said is there's a suppressed premise, a presumption in passing the law to stop the bad discrimination. And you know, you just distinguish between good discrimination and bad discrimination. And the presumption is that if you allow all discrimination, that all discrimination or the majority of discrimination will be bad. Yep. There's a presumption that people are unethical, immoral, malevolent at their core. And what that does by having that presumption is what it actually hurts is the good discrimination.
And as we pointed out in the show in articles talking about the cake baker out of Colorado who a couple wanted to force to bake their wedding cake, you're not actually stamping out discrimination when you're forcing these businesses to do business with you because you're giving them money. You are propping them up in the market. You are making sure they are more successful because you are requiring them to take your money in return for a service. So if we really genuinely wanted to stamp out oppression, we should allow these people to be oppressors and then institute boycotts and tell our friends and family who are not idiots to not go to these places and watch them die out instead of arbitrarily prop them up with money, which is a ludicrous proposition. But there was an even more ludicrous proposition this week, tweeted by our favorite President Trump, Donald Trump.
I was like, wait, there's another Trump? Are you telling us something?
Sometimes I think his daughter's running the country. But so this week, the president was all anti-China, as he usually is, but this week a little more than normal. And he tweeted out an extraordinary edict demanding that U.S. companies move out of China. And it left industries of every stripe trying to figure out what the hell their actual obligation is. So businesses from retail to electronics to home goods, many already underwater from months-long U.S.-China trade wars, were contacting their industry associations for guidance and awaiting more substantive announcements from the White House. Maggie, unpronounceable last name, said, quote, "I'm trying to keep my cool and not get worried and upset, but it's becoming hard." She mentioned that she's already working with industry colleagues to discuss moving some of her manufacturing from China to India or South Africa. She says, quote, I don't know how much faster I can move or how much more urgency I can have. So Donald Trump basically sent out a series of tweets, not the least of which is one where he said, "I hereby order companies to seek alternatives to China." And so the question is, can Trump do that? Can Trump hereby order U.S. businesses out of China? Justin, not asking for a legal analysis, but can the president of the United States do that?
I mean, can he tweet that? Yes, he's able to. Does it legally binding? Again, I'm not a legal analyst, but I'm pretty sure no, it's not legally binding. So if I were a business owner, I would not freak out over this. I would just ignore it. Honestly, if you just ignore Twitter, like, your life gets so much better. This is an example of what Trump has done to our culture, and he's using this to be an influencer, basically. He's the influencer in chief, where he's using his position as president to try and make people feel a certain way and act a certain way. All this is the only reason this tweet carries any weight is because he's the president. That's it. That's all he's doing. He knows he's the president. If he says this, he might scare people into actually doing it. He's just trying to shape the culture. He's using social justice tactics to get what he wants out of things.
Absolutely.
Now, there's an argument whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Then maybe you could address that if you want. But for me, it's just this is why I think all politicians should get off of social media. I don't think your job as a politician is as a government official is to be an influencer. We've talked about it before, how politics is downstream of culture. And I think when we have there's no distinction between influencer and politician, I think that's why part of the reason we're in such a big mess right now is everyone's out there all the time. They're not doing anything directly anymore. It's just, I'm going to do these things to try and force people or trick people into doing what I want. It's not that I'm going to say what I stand for and change laws based upon that. And that creates a very dangerous governmental and political system.
Yeah. So there is a legal question about whether or not Trump can do this. We'll get into that in a second. But I think the other side of that influencer coin, that politician influencer coin where they shouldn't be doing it because they're not culture warriors, I think the dark side of that coin, the side facing the carpet when you flip that coin, is that it's an influencer, but it's coming from an influencer who has the power to initiate force against you, right? So it's coming from someone who we've given the legal authority to arrest us and put us in jail or any number of things. Like, they can legally intern us. So that's what makes it particularly frightening, and particularly frightening then in the context of this is not the president of the Philippines. This is not the president of North Korea. This is not the president of China. This is the president of the United States of America, ostensibly the land of the free. The point of the country was to get rid of people who would give edicts like this and to tell them to F off, right? And now you have the president of the United States going to Twitter and hereby commanding that companies get out of China. It should be, no matter what, and especially a Republican, someone from the party that quote-unquote likes free trade and freedom, the response should be a universal go fuck yourself. I don't like to swear on this show anymore, but that should be the universal reply. It should be everyone on Twitter should just reply to that tweet with the middle finger emoji. That should be it. And we should move on with our lives, because the president of the United States shouldn't say this kind of crap.
But again, that begs the question, quite literally, of what you said. How do you give the middle finger to that tweet when he's commanding everyone to do something and he has the force behind it? Isn't the fear then that if you do that, he's going to seek out everyone who gives the middle finger to that tweet and arrest them and use force against them?
It is. But it totally is. But we should look at what's going on in Hong Kong right now and see that the only legitimate response to this kind of show of force, at least, if not actual force, because I don't think Trump is actually going to round up his dissenters, no, is to tell them to F off. It's not to capitulate. It's not to explain. It's not to be an apologist for. It's to tell him this is unacceptable. Go F yourself.
I don't think I've said this on the show before, Daniel, but I saw a tweet that I thought was hilarious and sums up things pretty well. I was saying that people in Hong Kong are protesting for American values and waving the American flag, while our two biggest protest groups are LARPing.
That does fairly well sum up Hong Kong versus Antifa, certainly.
Well, and they were lumping the Proud Boys into that. Whether that's legitimate to lump the Proud Boys in or not, it was still funny. That's why they were saying our two biggest protest group, because it was at the time in Portland. It was when Antifa and the Proud Boys were going at each other.
We haven't talked much about the Hong Kong protests on this show. Maybe we will as they escalate. But it really is just a stark, radical difference to see those protesters actually fighting real oppression, saying with signs and speeches and whatnot that they need their own Second Amendment from the United States Constitution, waving the American flag, singing our national anthem, as protests reading our Constitution aloud, whereas in the United States, we're protesting over, bathrooms and whether or not the president is a fascist here. And maybe that's somewhat contrary to what I just said about giving the president the middle finger, but ultimately my point is, as Adam Carolla would say, we're out of problems. And so we don't really know what oppression looks like. We really don't know what fascism looks like. We really certainly don't know what communism looks like if people are wanting socialism, which is the kind and gentle road over to communism. So it's really a stark contrast.
100%. And in relation to that, what I want to ask you is what you were saying about, politicians shouldn't act this way, so on and so forth, because of force. I think that melds very well with my point that politicians shouldn't be on social media. So let me ask you, I'm making a moral point, right? I'm not making a legal point when I'm saying that. So let me ask you the legal point. Would it be anti-freedom to say if you're holding a government office, you can't be on social media? Or would there just have to be a law that says you have to have a personal social media account that doesn't represent the office?
That would have to be, I think, what it is. I think it would be perfectly acceptable, and I think maybe preferable, I would have to look at the arguments, to say that politicians, in their capacity as a lawmaker, in their capacity as someone who can violate your rights, cannot be on social media. But as a candidate or as a private citizen, they can, as long as it doesn't cross over into that realm. That would be probably somewhat hard to enforce, but I'd be interested in looking at that kind of regulation of social media instead of the kind that folks like Senator Hawley are, where they're trying to take away our freedoms. So,
well, and to be fair to Trump,
yeah,
he did tweet it from his personal account, did he not?
But there is, he tweets many official government things from his personal account.
Right,
he doesn't
and
tweet
as you're
them
saying,
from at the White House or whatever.
Right, 100%, I agree with you. But as you're saying, this is very hard to delineate between those two if it were a law. So
yes,
I think the point is Trump knows what he's doing when he's doing all this. There's a reason he used his personal account from the beginning, I believe.
Yeah, except that he used the words, "I hereby order," which is a very...
I'm not defending this at all. This is absolutely fucking retarded. It's stupid. It's as I said, he's trying to influence people. And as you're pointing out, he's using force implicitly behind that. I'm not defending that. I'm just saying he knows what he's doing. And this is a very interesting regulation that I think should occur. Sorry, libertarians, for saying regulation should occur. Don't take that drop out of context, please.
Well, many people have beliefs that are unjustifiable, and primarily because they've become a luxury symbol in the United States. So this comes from an op-ed in the New York Post, which I think is particularly fascinating. So it starts off with a little story. It says, a former classmate from Yale recently told me that monogamy is outdated and not good for society. So I asked her what her background is and if she planned to marry, and she said she comes from an affluent family and works at a well-known tech company. And yes, she intends to have a monogamous marriage, but quickly added that marriage shouldn't have to be for everyone. She was raised by a traditional family. She planned on having a traditional family, but she maintained that traditional families are old-fashioned and society should evolve beyond them. So the author asks, well, what could explain this? Because the author was starting to see this in any number of other places as well. And so his hypothesis is that we feel pressure to display our status in certain ways. But in a country with so much affluence like the United States, where we can all afford an iPhone and a nice car and a big TV, there's no way to show your status with luxury goods. So today people are taking on luxury beliefs. These are ideas and opinions that confer status on the rich at very little cost, while they take a toll on people who actually believe these things in the lower class. So one example is this family structure, saying that all family structures are equal. Evidence is clear that families with two married parents are the most beneficial for young children, and yet affluent, educated people raised by two married parents are more likely than others to believe monogamy is outdated. Another luxury belief is that religion is irrational or harmful, according to the author. Members of the upper class are more likely to be atheists, but they have the resources and access to thrive without the unifying social edifice of religion. And then finally, the author makes the argument that white privilege is another luxury belief that is overwhelmingly believed by white people. In fact, the biggest group of people who are likely to believe in white privilege is young white people. Yet, we all know the status of that. So, Justin, I think this is a fascinating concept. Do you agree with the thesis of the author?
I agree with it so much that I'm going to ask you a question. Is the author of this, the name of the author of this article, just a pseudonym for Adam Carolla? Does this not sound like what you were saying in the last article about Adam Carolla? Does this not sound like Adam Carolla? It 100% does. It's the idea that you can hold a belief that doesn't affect you because you have so much wealth that you have fuck you or fuck me money, I think is 100% true. And the idea that if people in the lower class hold the beliefs, it just would hurt them, I think is 100% true, because you have this layer of insulation between yourself and reality when you have so much affluence. And what I'm referring to when you said that we're inventing problems now. These people have that layer between reality because they don't have problems. Where in the lower class, they have real problems to deal with.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's fascinating to see the beliefs that people hold when there are no consequences for holding those beliefs. When the benefit they get from holding that belief is that they get to be part of an in-group, but the consequence from actually believing that thing is zero because they don't practice it. This has been a critique of certain communities for a long time. I know that, like, Dennis Prager, for instance, and other conservative Jewish thinkers have said that that other Jewish people on the left should preach what they practice, because they have very traditional families, they believe in monogamy and education and whatnot, but when they vote for people who have very different views from their own. So when you detach your belief from the consequences of that belief, you get a very messed up belief economic structure.
Well, and I would even ask, based upon what you just said, Daniel, what actually defines a belief? Is it what you say you believe, or is it what you act on? So in the case you're talking about, if they're living their lives one way and saying that they believe other things, which do they really believe? Because I would suppose that what they actually believe is what they actually do in their personal individual lives, not what they're saying they believe publicly, and not what they're voting on.
I agree, like 51%. The 49% is this notion of what do they advocate for. And yes, they have those beliefs, but what do you advocate for? And you might be compartmentalized enough to think that the things you advocate for are the superior beliefs, but they, you know, don't work for you, or you're just not good enough to do them, or any number of other things that would sort of keep your self-esteem down, which is partially why you have this weird dichotomy, I would argue.
I was going to answer your dichotomy with the self-esteem thing. What you were just saying was just describing a complete lack of self-esteem. If something mm-hmm. works for you and you're saying, oh, well, this works for me, but it's not really what I believe because I'm just not good enough to apply these other beliefs, well, that's a self-esteem issue. And what I ultimately mean by that is you've assessed reality, and your reality has led you to beliefs as to how to deal with it, and you're dealing with it, and you're being successful in reality, but you're ultimately saying your judgment of reality is so flawed that you're only surviving in a pragmatic way.
Right. Absolutely. And this is partially that we teach that there's a distinction between beliefs and actions, that there's a mind-body dichotomy, that you can have ideas and they don't necessarily have, they're, you know, those are just your opinions, those are your beliefs, those are your ideas, and no one can tell you because you're living your truth, etc.
This is an audio podcast, but I'm dancing right now because preach it.
And there isn't. Your mind and your body are not disconnected. They are one thing that must be integrated in order for you to have a successful, flourishing life. So you should indeed preach the ideas you practice and practice the ideas you preach, and there should not be a distinction. If you believe that something works in reality for you, you should advocate for that thing. And if you don't believe it and think that it doesn't work, you shouldn't advocate for that thing. And this is why we shouldn't have the dichotomous teams that we have. It's part of the reason I think politics is so vile in the United States, is we have these two teams and you have to pick one team or the other, and you have to advocate for that team even if you disagree with 49% of what that team believes in, because it's your team. We have no teams here at the Midside. We have ourselves. We have the great I, the individual, the you.
Also, Daniel,
you
decide once again,
what is right and wrong.
Once again, this goes to the Batman quote. If there is even a 1% chance he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. That quote is collectivism. That's what you just said.
Yeah. So think for yourselves, people.
It's insane, yes.
And you'll all have better lives.
100%. And the question I would ask you is, based upon what you just said, does it say something else about our culture, or does it just say something in general that when you reach a certain status, that your primary concern is if you're socially accepted or not? Or is it just in general, everyone is so, I would say, second-handed in our culture?
Yeah, I don't know if it's an our culture thing. I think it's a somewhat human thing. And I don't mean to say that it's a universal human trait, but it's something that humans have dealt with for a long time. Obviously, the, you know, the being part of a group versus being the an individual. It's when you put an emphasis, because again, it's a false dichotomy, right? We can all be part of groups, and that is part of being an individual, is choosing which groups to be a part of. It's when you elevate the group status. It's when you say that the collective is more important than the individual, that I think you start to have detrimental psychological effects on the individual, because they start to distort their worldviews based on what the group thinks and not what they think.
Wow. What you just said is extremely powerful. When you elevate the group over the individual, I think that speaks to what we're going to talk about on Life on the Midside.
Mm.
And I think that speaks to a lot of the problems I've had and identified within the movement to release the Snyder Cut, where I would say those people have elevated belonging to the group of the people who want to see the Snyder Cut released over their individual desire and value of the Snyder Cut. So I think that is a tremendous way to end the news this week. Do not value the group over the individuals in it, specifically yourself, the ultimate individual in any group. And we do that here in the Midside. Even though I founded the Midside, if the other people in the Midside were to act up, I would just kick them out or dissolve the Midside. Because you know what matters more? Me. And because I'm in charge, I can say, I hereby order you to get out of this show. And all you listeners, I hereby order you to move on to The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off. In the last season when I wasn't focused on.
As always, Midsiders, if you want to join the conversation, you need to join our Discord channel. I can't remember the name of the Midsider who popped into Discord this week, but it was very hilarious. He popped in and he was like, hey, I finally joined Discord. I just wanted to let you know that whoever saw Once Upon a Time and said it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood said it was naturalistic only saw the second act. And that person hasn't said anything since. But you know what? That's what I want. If that is your one contribution, if you pop into Discord and you say something like that, and that is the one thing you say, you know what? You get what the Midside is about. And I appreciate the fact that that Midsider felt that strongly. So pop on in, join Discord, join the discussion. It makes the show better. It makes my life better on a daily basis. The shit I hear all the time, and then I hear things from you Midsiders, it makes my life a lot better. I want to talk about something that's somewhat relevant to the last story. I saw the movie Ready or Not. If you remember from Trailer Takedown, Ready or Not was about the girl who marries into the family of old wealth, and they're a board game empire. And the tradition on the wedding night is you pull a card, and if the card is hide and seek, they try and hunt you.
Is this the Rian Johnson movie?
No, it's not Rian Johnson. Why are you saying that?
I thought he... Oh, no, his is Knives Out or something like that.
Right,
Sorry.
His is the Knives Out with the terrible, like, what is this, CSI, blah, 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 whatever that fucking stupid joke is. No, you know this one is not Rian Johnson because people actually laughed in the theater while watching it. People had a good time while watching it.
Ouch.
For this Ready or Not... Oh, okay, I get you. Yeah. No, I will say, though, I was at while we're on this tangent, I was at D23 yesterday, like outside with the release of Snyder Cut sign. The number of people who came up to us were like, yeah, man, you guys are really upset about the Snyder Cut. You know what we're upset about? The Last Jedi. And they would just sit there and talk to us for like 10 minutes going on and on about The Last Jedi. And I'm just like, yeah, I know, man. Like, it's all terrible. And there's people are really angry about The Last Jedi still.
Hashtag release any other cut.
Some guy was like, my favorite was a guy, he was like, you know, I like JJ and I think he loves Star Wars, but I don't think he could fix it. I think he would need like a 5.5-hour movie to fix everything The Last Jedi did. I was like, damn, dude, I thought I was angry. Anyway, back to this movie, which is not Rian Johnson. It's two directors and two writers that are relative unknowns. And so they pull the card, the hide and seek card, and they hunt the person who married into the family, and that person has until midnight to survive. Now, the reason they do this, and this is left up to mystery in this movie until the very end of the movie, so I will be doing spoilers in this review. They do this because they believe, based on a deal their great-grandfather made, that if they don't do this, something bad will happen to their family. So if they don't perform a sacrifice by dawn, that something bad will happen to the family. Later, they specifically say they'll die, and they give an example of another family who weren't able to complete the ritual, and they died in a house fire. And somebody said, well, that's what the media said, it was a house fire. They're like, well, if you really believe that, you don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. So the whole movie follows the girl who marries into the family, and she's trying to survive. It's very much a dark comedy. It's like a horror comedy, which you know is one of my favorite genres, if you've been listening to the show or you're my friend. And it had some subversions in the writing. It had some inversions. I was able to call most of it. But then the ending was very funny. So it gets to the end, and you think you've seen all the twists, and then the dawn happens, and then none of them die, right? So the girl's alive, they're about to sacrifice her, and dawn happens, and none of them die. And then everyone's like, wait, well, maybe it wasn't real at all. It completely was fake. And you're like, okay, that's a good way to go with this movie. And it just lets it sit there for a moment, and then randomly, one of the people explodes just out of nowhere and everyone laughs. And then all the family members start exploding and it's absolutely hilarious. And then they have some commentary at the end between the husband and the wife, and she throws the ring at him and he explodes because ultimately he chose the family over her. And it's a very enjoyable time at the movies. So that's the first thing I want to say is if you like horror comedy, it's a very enjoyable time at the movies. But well, everything burned down, although that's an interesting point, right? So early in the movie, they showed the matriarch of the family, the mother, her mother-in-law, with a cigarette case that was worth a lot of money. And she was like, oh, I really like your case. The daughter-in-law was like, or the daughter was like, I really like your case, the one marrying into it, the bride. And at the end of the movie, after all the family's dead, she takes the case and goes outside and smokes while the house is burning behind her. So that's a really interesting commentary there, William, that you said. I believe that's setting up a sequel, but I think that was intentional on the writers and directors part, especially because she did see the spirit that they were trying to give a sacrifice to right before she left the house. The spirit appears and like nods to her and disappears. So there is some interesting stuff there. On a deeper level here, I read a lot of the reviews. This has an 86% on Rotten Tomatoes. Let's play a game right now. Can you guys guess why it has an 86% on Rotten Tomatoes?
Feminism?
Sort of. Because the female character, the female lead. No, it's because it's saying that they think that it's simply saying rich people are evil. That's what they think this is. Oh, this is how fucked up the rich and evil are, or the rich and powerful are. They're evil, right? Now, there's been a couple of interviews with the writers, and they are going in that direction. But the important thing is, thematically in this movie, these are people with old wealth. This is almost relevant to what we were talking about with the luxury beliefs thing. These people are so disconnected from reality and how the money was made that they've lost their way. So that's why it's very interesting at the end that the ghost nods at her. Like he was happy that she was able to make it so that these people were eradicated. It was almost like they thought they were doing this for Satan. They even say Hail Satan at one point. But it's almost like they're not doing that. Especially because the son could have gotten away with her and been not part of the family anymore. And what I mean by that is, at the end, after everyone's exploded, it's just him and her, the woman he married, and he, you know, begs her for forgiveness and everything, and she throws the ring at him, the wedding ring, and was like, I want a divorce. And the second the ring hits him, he explodes. Earlier in the movie, he had said, you know, she makes me better. I wanted away from all of you, and I went to her, and she makes me better. She's a good person, whereas you all are not. And then he chooses his family later, and it results in him dying. But even earlier in the movie, in a discussion with his wife, he said, she was like, why couldn't we just elope? And he seemed to believe that if they had eloped, he still would have died with all of them. So there was also a very interesting point in here about family, what it teaches us, our obligations to family, and how your choices define who you are and makes you a good person or not. And you're not defined by who you came up, what family you came up with and their belief system. So there's a lot going on in this movie, and it's not as simple as simply the rich or evil, especially because they make a point to, and even the setting is like an old, it felt like an old New England mansion, like almost, you don't really go outside that much. So you almost feel like it could be set in New England, like Rhode Island, like almost like Newport, Rhode Island type deal. So I think this is a great movie. I would say see it. You should see it if you like good movies. I would say don't see it if you're going to be super sensitive to this whole idea that rich people are evil. And also don't see it if you just don't like gore and don't like horror. You're just not going to like the genre. So I would say that's the only reason not to see that kind of movie. Otherwise, I think it's an exemplary example of the horror comedy genre. Let's move on now to Trailer Takedown, which I know Daniel has been waiting for. Ugh? What, hug. Daniel?
Hug, Justin. Hug. Oh, the two words we use, hug and tackle.
I
might think about the context of what we're going into.
Yeah. I was about to...
Good morning.
The problem was you subverted my joke before I said it. I thought I was going to say something like, oh, you were like just trying to get through. You were like, just shut up already with the review. But all right. So I'm just going to shut up and we're just going to go into Trailer Takedown. Go ahead, William, with the sound effects.
Hug. Trailer Takedown.
It's our special hug edition.
First trailer. First trailer.
Okay.
The Mandalorian.
Yay!
Is the trailer for the new Bounty Hunter series on Disney Plus, starring The Mandalorian, which I guess is the name of a bounty hunter in Star Wars. There's so much going on here just mythologically that Daniel's going to need to talk about it. I'm just going to say from an aesthetic standpoint, there's not much story-wise going on here for me to comment on, but beyond the fan service of Lando, which I thought really broke the tone of this trailer, the trailer is otherwise tremendous. And I actually was like, yeah, this is pretty good. I want to see this. So I would say you also need to see the version of this where they put Cats, the music from the Cats trailer over it, which is hilarious because it works perfectly. And it shows how they use the same beats in a lot of trailers, even if they don't have the same content. But yeah, this is... I'm a non-Star Wars guy, and this is a hug for me.
Hug.
Wow. Way to step on it,
Justin. So it's rare that I hug something this hard in the show, but my God, this looks good. Finally. I'm so much more excited about this than I am about The Rise of Skywalker after the Last Jedi ruined the main series of movies. Justin, Mandalore is a planet.
Okay.
And Mandalorians would be the sort of warrior culture. And so the armor that this person is wearing is Mandalorian battle armor, which is the same kind of armor that Boba Fett wore and his father Jango Fett wore before him.
Okay, that was the question I wanted to ask you mythologically. Remember when they were doing all the side movies and then that died because they fucked up Solo? And one of the rumored ones was Boba Fett. Is this show replacing that Boba Fett movie because this is the show that's going to be about bounty hunting in the Star Wars universe?
I think so, yeah. Also because Kathleen Kennedy learned a little lesson with Solo. So yes, I think this is going to be what replaces that. Now, in this timeline, since this happens after the Return of the Jedi, Boba Fett is dead, having been killed by being thrown into the Sarlacc pit in Return of the Jedi. So, this is a new Mandalorian wearing Mandalorian armor who is just out bounty hunting, and it looks badass.
So Boba Fett's a Mandalorian too?
Well, he's wearing Mandalorian battle armor. I don't remember my canon, my new canon, but I'm not sure he is Mandalorian himself.
Okay.
The one thing that took me out of this trailer was Werner Herzog randomly in the trailer saying, like, bounty hunting is a hard profession. Don't you agree? I was like, what the? I didn't know we were in a documentary mode for a second. That was very strange. But other than that, I'm all in. The hardest hug I've ever hugged on this show.
Hug.
Yeah.
Appropriate really? Drop usage. Also, Daniel, you realize without that final line, idiots like me wouldn't have known this was about bounty hunting?
Well, I get it that idiots like you wouldn't know that. Just kidding. My point is...
No, it's a fair use of the word idiot.
Werner Herzog. Just, he's off screen, and then you hear, bounty hunting is a hard profession. I'm like, oh, it's a documentary about bounty hunting. That was what I thought immediately. But anyway.
All right, William.
There were no white gay dudes in the preview, only minorities and people wearing masks. So I think we haven't avoided the social justice cut of this story. So I'm extremely apprehensive. I'm sort of afraid to further sully my memories of Star Wars with anything further, which is why I did not watch Solo. And honestly, I'm on the fence. I think based on this preview, I don't see much of what the plot or the theme is going to be. The problem with that is I have to fill in the gap based on previous evidence. And if this is going full SJW, then I'm not going to watch it. So I'm going to wait till Daniel watches it and reassess. But for now, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Whoa, William.
I think in all shows from now on, shows and movies, white people should wear masks.
But don't. I don't want to see their whiteness, masks, Justin.
I'm curious what you thought. Did you watch Rogue One? What did you think of Rogue One?
I thought, William. I thought Rogue One was kind of. My dog is sleeping and making funny noises. I thought Rogue One was okay. It could have been. I think with the creepy what was he, Admiral?
Director
CGI,
Krennic.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, you mean Tarkin?
Tarkin.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think that was a little creepy. I don't know I would ask you what was the theme of that movie? It was the theme just pure sacrifice?
I've struggled with that. I would say that even in the darkest hour, there is hope, right? Because that's sort of how it ends, and then it introduces a new hope as the next movie. So, I was thinking, like, the theme is essentially, like, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how down you are, no matter how awful it is, there is always hope.
Yeah, I can see that. I think the problem with it is, in a way, it was very paint by the numbers, the plot, right?
Yeah.
But in another way, there wasn't enough connections, and I'm not necessarily saying they need to be like related, like family related, but connections between the characters in Rogue One and the characters in A New Hope. Yeah. There was sort of like, oh, you're just supposed to buy into that these people care, right? There was no real motivation. They were just sort of robots started in progress.
I get that. I get that criticism. And Justin, we've now hijacked your show entirely with Star Wars talk. I think my point...
It's okay. It's D23 weekend when we're recording this. So.
About bringing it up is only that this reminds me of the feel of the Rogue One movie, which has a very different feel from the other Star Wars stuff, I thought. And if you liked that, I think you might like The Mandalorian. Also... How many guns were there in this trailer, William? Come on,
there were guns and there were trooper heads on spikes. I know. Yeah. I'm telling you. It was a hard call. It was a. I don't want to be a fence sitter, so I have to call the shots where I see them. And this one is on the tackle side. I mean, if you come back and you tell me that there are white people in it and they aren't all bad guys and there's no Mary Sue's. And that characters are motivated and make choices, then I'll be in.
All right. Well, good thing William shot first.
Can I say something about the quote unquote heads on the spikes?
Yeah.
Can I just say that effect doesn't play well when the heads are in masks because it looks like helmets are just on spikes? I literally thought that. I watched that. I go, so are those decapitated people with their heads on spikes, or are those just masks on spikes? It doesn't play well if you're putting the masks on the spikes, because you could have just stolen people's masks.
Yeah, I get it. I'm not gonna. I won't. I have thoughts, but I'll leave them for another
time. No, it looked cool, but I'm just saying it's unclear whether they're actually decapitated heads or not. That's all I'm saying.
It's just supposed to be warding off Imperials and leftover Imperials. That's all.
That's fine. Okay, as long as we're clear about that.
Okay.
Second trailer.
Lady and the Tramp is the live-action Lady and the Tramp movie that I had no idea was coming out, is being exclusively released on Disney Plus.
Wow.
It looks like they're not shooting this in the same way as The Lion King. It looks like they're using actual animals, so I appreciated that. But Disney, because of social justice, William, and I'm interested to see if you notice this and to see what you think about this, they backed into a problem that they didn't realize. So Lady and all of her people and everything are voiced by black women or acted by black women. And the only like white male voice is the Tramp. So the whole point of Lady and the Tramp is like Tramp teaches Lady like how to live in reality. Right, it's like the blue collar person, you know, with the white collar person, blah blah blah. So they've essentially created a movie which is subversively about a white man teaching a black woman how to live. They didn't do it on purpose, but they did what was ultimately going to happen at some point with the social justice crap. They backed into a controversy that I don't know if anyone's going to notice. I'm not a big fan of the original Lady and the Tramp. I mean, it's iconic imagery, but I think this is another example of the lack of anthropomorphism in the live action. How the hell are you going to have two real dogs eat spaghetti and kiss in the middle? It doesn't work. It does not work unless they're humanized. Unless they're made to be human, which only works in animation. Tackle. Daniel?
Was literally anyone asking for this? Now, I get that, like, entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs were a genius and no one was really asking for the iPad and he invented an entire category of thing. But in the art world, especially in the remake world, is there a market for this? Is there anyone who wants this? Or are there just people who will watch anything Disney creates at this point? This looks awful. Awful. It was painful to watch this trailer. Just watch the original. It's fantastic. I know it's not your favorite, but it is a fantastic movie overall. This is garbage on a plate. Tackle.
Ugh, tackle.
So I've gone through several phases of grief after watching this trailer. I'm currently in the anger phase. We are Disney. Why are you wasting such animation talent on naturalism? The fact that we have these tools now and we've developed the artistry to use these tools in such a way to make things that, if you look at a frame, looks beautiful. But we're forgetting the whole point of animation is the stylization and the way that you can bring emotion and character alive on the screen. Something that a director of a live action thing cannot do. And this is just a tremendous waste of talent. And it looks absolutely creepy and terrible when you see the frames in motion. This is not... This is an incredible waste. We're wasting an entire generation of artists at Disney on this. They're going to keep doing this. All of the movies are going to get remade. So that's my current phase. Tackle.
Tackle!
That was awesome.
Third trailer.
The Report is an Amazon Prime original series. This trailer was submitted by Midsider Megan. Now, I don't know all the details of the actual events of this. I probably should. I probably know exactly what report and everything. I thought there was a lot compelling about this. This was about the report that came out after 9/11, dealt with like torture and everything. I just worry about a show like this because, you know, I agreed it where they had at the end where they were like, so whatever was about the truth mattering, blah, blah, blah. I agree with that. But this is one of those that I'm afraid the left is going to take and hijack and make it about, you know, oh, the truth matters, but we're going to spin it as if the truth is what our perspective was on it, not we're going to actually find the truth about it. So I'm going to have to do what William did for the first trailer, where even though there was a lot I liked about this, I liked the pacing, I liked the atmosphere, there was some about the content I really liked. Because I worry where this will ultimately go, I could change my opinion if, you know, Midsider Megan and Midsider Frank, or, you know, Daniel, I'm assuming he'll watch this, tell me it's good, but for now, I'm going to tackle this.
Tackle?
Pretty much. Daniel?
Political thriller starring some amazing people. I'm in, of course. Yes, this will be taken by the left and appropriated for their means. I think overall that's going to be fine in terms of this particular story, although there is a lot of dispute about how much good information did come from the waterboarding and torture of certain people. So I'll be interested to see how they handle that exactly. But no matter what, I'm in, because it's my genre. Hug.
Hug.
William?
This is another one I was kind of setting on the fence for. Much like Justin said, it has some hints that there's going to be some good acting and at least the story being presented in an interesting way. I'm definitely not going to watch this movie for anything related to historical accuracy. So in that, if I can approach it in that way, then yes, I will hug this.
Hug?
Think of it as a Tarantino film.
Final trailer.
Villains is a horror comedy movie about a young couple who has committed a robbery at a convenience store, and they break into a house to hide out in their getaway, and they find out that the older couple who lives in that house are actually even more evil than they are. The older couple is played by Kira Sedgwick and Jeffrey Donovan. They look tremendous in these roles. I like the colorization they have here, like the slightly yellowish tint, works really well. It looks like there could be a lot of great elements in this. And as Daniel said, this is my genre. So this for me is a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, we have inverse genres.
Yeah, I was wondering what you were going to say about that. I baited you. What do you mean by inverse genres?
I can't. Like, it was hard for me to get through this trailer. It made me uncomfortable. I didn't care about any of the characters. I didn't laugh once. I'm just not into this kind of thing. I don't know. It's very grotesque to me in a certain way, and I don't like it. So, tackle.
Tackle.
I agree it's grotesque, but the amusement comes in the fact that it's fucked up people and grotesque things are happening to them. So it's kind of like, ha-ha.
William?
Yeah, I'm kind of with Daniel on this one. This is a hard trailer to watch. I can see that it might be stylized and there might be some might be some commentary here. Like, is this a Marxist commentary? Like, you've got the upper class evil people repressing the lower class evil people. But even that is not enough to think I could stomach setting through this. So, no. I'm going to tackle.
Tackle!
If they go in that direction, I'll be very disappointed. I'm hoping that's not it, but that would actually be... It'd be kind of funny in a fucked up way if they went that direction, but otherwise it would be very disappointing. But when we're talking about things that are kind of funny in a fucked up way, but ultimately disappointing, I think that's a great way to head into Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this line goes on. Because I'm on the road. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. Friend of the Midside / Midsider. I just try to distinguish because Stuart's been a good friend of mine for a while. Stuart Margolis wrote an article for the Objective Standard called How I Avoided the Struggles of Most Young Gay People. And it's all about how individualism and self-esteem and objectivism are actually very much in line with the coming out process of a young gay person. It's interesting. It's something I've probably talked about before with him or other gay people because, I mean, maybe William can speak to this, but there are a lot of gay men, especially in the objectivist quote-unquote movement. But the interesting thing...
Sexy. Gay men. Love that part.
Okay.
Thank you.
So this became a dating segment for William, apparently. Do you want to say your phone number, William?
My Twitter handle, and I'm on Discord.
309.
Slide into those DMs, boys.
Slide into those DMs. He's giving you his handle.
Okay.
No? Okay. All right. I was trying to be punny there. But yeah, so, okay. The cat is playing with something. It's annoying with me. Stop it! She got on a shelf and knocked over a Funko Pop and is using the stand for the Funko Pop, and I can hear it on the ground. I'm just being hypervigilant. Okay. So the interesting thing is not this specific issue. The interesting thing is something Daniel pointed out is the backlash against this article, which is kind of insane to me. Daniel, do you want to sum up how you found it and... what you think of the backlash or just characterize it? I mean, yeah, I've already said it's insane, so...
I'm friends with a wide swath of objectivists. I have blocked very few of them, despite getting, you know, in the past 10 years, maybe 150 messages of, if you don't block this person, you're not a real objectivist. Basically, don't block anyone save for, like, the top half percent of the worst people who I just can't stand. So... There was a particular person who basically shared this article and said that the Objective Standard was unobjective for publishing this and that Ayn Rand herself did not like homosexuality and therefore basically people promoting homosexuality are not being objective for doing so. And the thread devolved into a bunch of different angles on homosexuality. That it was contra human nature, that it was a choice, that it was it spread disease at one point was brought up, and that you know, one of the
I mean, heterosexual sex has never ever spread disease, not even once,
not even the disease of stupidity.
That's right. And so, but ultimately, it's sort of, if you cut through the bigotry and the total nonsense, there is a question here that is interesting about, is something Ayn Rand said in a question and answer session, sort of off the cuff, part of her philosophy? And should we adhere to it because she said it? That's a tiny bit of a straw man, I think, but it is a thread of ongoing discussion now. I know that's the particular angle you wanted to talk about, Justin, because the is homosexuality immoral question is almost laughably easy to refute at this point, that we need spend more than 10 seconds actually doing so.
Go ahead if you want to. Go ahead if you want to do that. I don't give a shit about that argument. Like, do whatever the fuck you want. I don't think it's immoral to be gay. Like, whatever. Do it. Like, if you want to refute the argument, go ahead.
Well, just quickly, you know, immorality has to do with choices, the choices that help you flourish and the choices that diminish your life. You know, what is moral is what is good for a flourishing human being, and what is immoral is what is bad. And I think one of the core distinctions here that's really easy is there was no choice in the matter. William, I don't think you at some point were like, sexualities. I circle
here's
gay.
The menu. Yeah. Make your decision. No.
He could have picked Jedi, but he picked gay.
I think it's important to handle the common objective there. You know, child molesters also don't choose their sexuality. So what's the difference between those two?
Gay people are only harming each other's butts.
I think you should answer the question, William, since you have
Me?
A particular experience.
Well, oh, I thought he was going to. That's why I said
no.
Thing.
I was
going to
let Dan.
I thought
Daniel
it
was
a rhetorical
such a good
question.
Job explaining. I was just throwing up. I was identifying as a woman and throwing up a common objection. Well,
thought it was a rhetorical question. That's why my response was so asinine. But continue.
Yeah, this Yeah, part of it is that, in that case, you're harming another person, right? Like, there's another person involved that's being harmed, the child in that case. But there's another side of that, too. You know, man has a nature, and we know from our limited objective knowledge in psychology that, you know, that sexuality and sexual behavior among mammals in general and humans in specific include these kinds of behaviors on a spectrum, right? So we know that it's part of the way people live, right? We can see that in society. It's a part of the way people live. And so our own evidence of our senses, our own way we see reality, we can see that there are happy couples that are homosexual or bisexual or polyamorous.
Or they're
we see
at least
those
things. They're at least as unhappy as the rest of us straight people.
So we have our own evidence to see that is part of the nature of being human.
Absolutely, and it's a thing where those people were making the argument that you could just choose, William. You could just choose to have sex with women. You could just choose it, and your life would be so much better if you just chose to have sex with women. And it just,
I mean, I could choose to eat spicy food all the time, but I'd be fucking miserable and it'd be painful. Like that's not an argument.
A conflation of the concept of choice, right? Which is, yes, I can choose to eat things I'm allergic to. I can choose to eat dog poo off the sidewalk. I can choose to stab myself repeatedly with a knife, but that doesn't make the choice good for me. And
it's a common conflation between the judging people, passing a moral judgment on something that people don't have a choice on and something that people do have a choice on. So for example, the thing I have in common, quote unquote, and this is going to get taken out of context someday, the thing I have in common with a child molester is that neither of us chose that sexuality. But the thing I don't have in common with a child molester is that when I act on those desires, I'm not harming other people.
Or yourself, I would argue. And that's
right.
the core argument.
Also, you don't want to molest children, to be fair. Just to be clear.
Yes.
And that's the argument they're making, is you're harming yourself by quote unquote choosing a homosexual.
Yeah.
It also,
just to put a bow on this, it also comes from a platonic idea of what an ideal man is versus the ideal I, the ideal me, right? The ideal William, when I'm not on the show identifying as a woman, is as a gay individual. Right. That's where I achieve my highest spiritual admiration. When I see those things I admire in a person concretized, it's in a male.
Yeah. And a choice to sleep with a woman, William, would not change your desire, because you cannot change your desire. It's not a possibility for you. We spent a lot of time talking about this now. I'll make one last point.
I don't
point,
know, man. Vagina is kind of magical. So I think if a gay guy was in a vagina, he'd be like, wow, suddenly I'm straight. I missed this magic. I mean, I don't know about
would
you,
the
but...
same, would the same thing happen in reverse?
No, because men are dirty and evil, so they're not magical in the same way a woman's vagina is.
Yes, the Justin M. Lesneski and the magical vagina. It's a good children's
no,
story.
That's the new Harry Potter sequel, Harry Potter careful. And the Magical Vagina.
Yes. I'll make one last point about this that I thought you can react to it is there seems to be a strange overlap between this weird argument that gay is a choice and you could just choose otherwise and the social justice argument about sleeping with trans women. Right, which is if you choose not to sleep with trans women, you're just a transphobe, and you could just choose to do it, and there would be no problem with it if you just chose to do it, you transphobe. It seems to be a very similar type of argument to me. Am I missing something?
No, I think it comes from the same ideas here that you're we talk about a lot, that you're applying you're taking a group and applying characteristics to individuals, right? Like, yes, humans overall, you know, what is it, 85% of them are heterosexual, right? But you can't just look at those 85% and say all the other 15% are immoral because they don't have that attribute or that they behave in a different way.
Yeah.
Well, I would just say it's more 90, of the, okay? The hypocrisy of the social justice movement. I mean... If you ever dared say that sexuality was a choice, you know, being gay was a choice, they'd be like, oh my God, you're so offensive. That's a micro-macro aggression. But now it's a choice whether you want to sleep with someone who's a penis or not. But it also has to do with the fact that they're trying to undermine the concept of gender.
Sex, much like the religious folks.
Well, yes, ultimately.
They're trying to tear mind from body. And so the only way to do that is you have to attack sex. You have to attack reason on the mind side. You have to attack sex on the body side.
I'm glad you brought up the religion point because these so-called objectivists who are critiquing Stewart's article in this concept of homosexuality remind me very much of religious zealots. And Justin, I know that's kind of the point you wanted to bring up about this in general.
Well, yeah, it goes back to what you were saying in the news segment where they're valuing the group over the individual. They're valuing the group over themselves. And the way they're doing that is with this religious fervor for Ayn Rand. And honestly, I don't give a shit what Ayn Rand thought. And what I mean by that with that controversial statement is...
Careful.
I give a crap what she said that was right. Okay. Even if she said things that were wrong within her philosophy, I wouldn't care about it. Now, do I think her philosophy is right as well as my knowledge of her philosophy is? Yeah, as well-versed as I am in her philosophy and philosophy, but I'm not a professional philosopher. I think she's right. But I don't give a crap about anything she was wrong about. You know why? Because she was wrong. I don't like Ayn Rand because she's Ayn Rand. I like Ayn Rand because of the good things and the correct things she did. Just like I don't like Zack Snyder because he's Zack Snyder. I like Zack Snyder because of the good things he's done and created. If Zack Snyder puts out a shit movie, I'll call it a shit movie. I've said there are things I like about the Owl movie, but I don't like it all that much. I said Dawn of the Dead's not that good. There are things I like about it, but it's not as good as his other movies. It's
Think
not
about,
about
if we... had this standard, Justin, to really concretize things in other areas of life where, say, for instance, Tom Brady has a totally crap game, throws some awful interceptions. You don't praise the interceptions because Tom Brady threw them, right? You praise Tom Brady because he generally throws tremendous passes.
It was 4D chess, all right?
It was 4D chess.
Yes. I mean, that's a similar thing, yes. But no, you're 100%. Now, you may go, well, he's won 6 Super Bowls. It's okay that he threw 2 interceptions in this game. Like, we'll let this one slide. And it's the same thing with Rand. Like, the things she said about homosexuality, the things she said on other issues, I let slide because she said a lot of good things. She did
because
a lot of good.
Because she's won 6 Super Bowls of
We also have a tremendous context dropping when people bring up that Rand quote. People don't remember that homosexuality was still classified as a mental disease back then. Now, we could try and build a time machine, and you know, I could sit with Ayn Rand and make an argument or two with her, and I think eventually we could convince her. But you know, that's a what if hypothetical. But based on the context of knowledge, then it was classified the same as child molestation, and there is some evidence to show that folks who are homosexual have higher instances of mental problems, right? Suicide rate is higher. Tons of things are higher, right? Yeah. So this isn't, you know, this was an error in judgment, right? Not in method.
Absolutely. And one of the things to keep in mind here is this wasn't in a treatise she wrote on sexuality. It wasn't in one of her novels where she spent two chapters talking about homosexuality being evil. It was in an off-the-cuff Q&A. And how many other things has she commented on that if you had froze it in time, she would have been wrong about? I don't know, smoking, for instance. If you froze it in time, and she has this great, glorious quote about, you know, fire at the end of a stick that man's controlling or whatever. And if you'd never asked her about that again or had any response from her again, would we have to say that smoking is part of objectivism and that it's a good thing to smoke and it's great because man's controlling fire? Or could we, with the new understanding and information that we have, say that that was a mistake she made? Now, that was one thing in her lifetime she corrected and updated and realized she was wrong about.
Well, when you get really, really sick from smoking all your life, you kind of correct that.
Of course. And so the point is, this is a snapshot in time of something she didn't have time to think a ton about, I think, and probably wasn't a main focus of her personal life or philosophy. So why are we taking this as gospel?
Well, because people aren't thinking themselves, Daniel. I mean, even you guys are getting a little bit into, like, you feel the need to defend Rand, so you're defending her in this way. I don't give a shit. Honestly, she said something wrong. Who gives a shit? If I need to sit here and defend her, that's a problem for somebody who needs to attack her because they're looking for a reason to attack her. This is a problem you're right. I've had with objectivism in general, the quote-unquote, not objectivism, the philosophy, but the objectivist movement, where, I mean, we saw this article come out recently in the New Republic, The Last of the Ayn Rand Acolytes, where this guy, he infiltrated OCON, the objectivist conference that the Ayn Rand Institute puts on, and he found all these things, blah, blah, blah. Look, I think the guy who wrote the article is an idiot, and I understand that it's the Ayn Rand Institute convention and not the objectivist convention, but the idea that people like, oh man, I'm going to get really into swing dancing because Ayn Rand's into it. You know, I'm going to get really into tiddlywink music because Ayn Rand was into it. Like, people who listen to this show, I hope you get into Zack Snyder because you like his art. You like his movies, not because you're like, oh man, I really like the Midside and I want to belong in the Midside, so I'm going to like Zack Snyder movies. It's a backwards way of coming to like things.
To be clear, defending Ayn Rand because she's the subject here, but my point is universal, I think, which is no matter who you're talking about, there's a difference, and we've talked about this before even with like Milo Yiannopoulos, not to compare the two intellectually, but the point being there's a huge difference between something you say off the cuff on a podcast or in a Q&A versus something you sit down and write a thesis about. That's 100%. Kind of my point.
I was just being rhetorical to make my point.
So how do we turn this back around to Midsiders? So first, Stuart, I enjoyed the article. And I really identified with it. But how should one deal with situations like this? I guess first from the perspective of you're seeing this behavior in an interaction that you're having. And then second, you know, how do you catch yourself from making these kinds of errors?
Yeah, the second is the more compelling question. When I see people doing this, I just ignore them because they're fucking stupid and they've got deeper issues that I don't want to deal with. So, like, when Daniel was showing me the comments, I was literally like, I was just like, these are fucking horrific people. That was my response. And I guess maybe having just the strength to judge them in that way is important. How do you avoid it yourself, Daniel? How would you answer that question?
So part of it is, depending on what we're talking about here, no matter what you're into, and this is a restatement of what we've already talked about, whether it's objectivism or
penis.
Sure. Careful,
or Patriots or Zack Snyder or whatever. The first and foremost thing you must establish is that these are values to you in your context, and you must decide for yourself what things are right and wrong. And this is a tenet of objectivism, right? If even Ayn Rand herself said if there was a commandment in objectivism, it would be think for yourself. And Leonard Peikoff has put this huge emphasis on understanding objectivism inductively, not deductively, looking at the world and learning the principles yourself because they are available to you through the evidence of your senses. And so just coming to things by actually looking at reality and judging accordingly and then saying, yes, these opinions conform with what I understand about reality is the only guard against any collectivist thinking. It's the only guard against any second-handedness. You must use your mind to decipher the world for yourself. Not because anyone else said anything for any reason. You must put the work in to do it.
And just to add on what you're saying, you must act according to how you judge the situation, right?
Yes.
According to your moral standards, right? Don't use someone else's moral standards. That is why I think there are so many gay, bi, and lesbian folks in the objectivist movement. It's because for many of us, our coming out story, because of where mine's a little different than Stuart's because my family was a little more religious, and by a little I mean a lot, is coming to that independent judgment that your standard of what is moral in the sexual realm is not my standard, right? We had to concretely do that, many of us, and so we have a different barometer, like a different experience than some other more sort of deductively understanding objectivists.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's interesting. That's a really interesting point experientially, William. I mean, I'm probably not going to say anything different than what the two of you have said, but for me, it's just like, focus on whether what's being added to your life is a value or not. And just keep focusing on that on a very pragmatic, practical level. Like, what this is where the focus on living it inductively, you're saying, comes from, Daniel. It's just like, so there's let's use the example of Zack Snyder, right? Zack Snyder, qua Zack Snyder, doesn't do anything for my life. Like, on a daily basis, Daniel, do you interact with Zack Snyder?
Only like every second or third Tuesday, so it's not that much.
All right, only every second or third Tuesday. Yeah,
I have dinner with Zack Snyder and Tom Brady tomorrow night. So
I hate you.
That's a euphemism for
okay. So now that I've been completely derailed, what's your primary mode of interaction with Zack Snyder? It's not Zack Snyder, it's his movies. So when you watch the movie, just literally say, is this better for my life or not? And I don't understand why, to bring this back to the article, why fucking straight people are replying to this article and be like, man, gay isn't part of objectivism. Why are you fucking worried about that? Are you secretly gay? Like, is that the problem here? Like, what the fuck? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me because they're not worried about their own life. They're not worried about their own life. So focus on your own life. That's what I would say.
There you go.
All right, let's put a bow on this episode, gentlemen. What did we learn this trip? William?
Well, it was a short trip for me because of my late attendance, but I did learn that that we could add that homosexuality being immoral as a luxury belief that is a status symbol for rich Americans.
Ooh, good one. I learned that it's a bad time to be Canadian. Because you can't even choose your own babysitters up there in Canada. Midsider Mark, what the hell are you doing up there? Come on, man. Fix it already. Justin?
I learned that I can hereby order you to leave Canada, Midsider Mark. You are not a Midsider if you keep staying in Canada.
That's right. We hereby order you to find an alternative to Canada. Yes. So thanks, everyone, for joining us this trip. And we hereby order you to check out our social media at The Midside everywhere where social media can be found. Also, themidside.com/podcast. Listen to all the past episodes. Catch up on your favorite shows. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Google Play. Give us 5 stars there. We're also syndicated through Liberty.me, thanks to our libertarian listeners out there. You can go to patreon.com/themidside to give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. It helps us keep the lights on. And I like lights. We thank all of our Patreon subscribers.
You can get some exclusive content. I thought you didn't like Canada, though. Why would you like the Canadian singer Lights?
That was a long way for a terrible joke.
The Ryan Johnson of puns.
Subverting expectations of humor. What else? Oh, tell a friend. That's really honestly the most important thing you can do is telling a friend about this show, because, man, we need more of you out there to really change the culture. We need more Midsiders. So bring them in. Bring them on into the Midside. And until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a gay day.
You seem really angry. Like,
what?
William seemed really angry about have a gay day.
Angry gays are the worst gays. Did you know that Ayn Rand likes Scrabble, and if you don't like Scrabble, you're immoral?
Oh, man. What if you like Beethoven?
Oh, you're basically out of the movement.
What if you like Goldfish?
I'm going to come out as loving Beethoven.
What if you don't like cats?
Oh, forget it. You're out of the podcast.
Yeah, River's going to yell at you.
Forget objectivism. You're out of the Midside.